you are a top level exercise professional. I'm going to say it again. How good does that sound? And as a career path, what a rewarding way to wake up every day helping people to be healthy, fit, and strong. So as an exercise professional, how do we choose the very best exercises for our clients, for our athletes, for children, for more mature and motivated people, for any person that comes into our life and says, please help me, you are an exercise professional and I would like to be healthy, fit, strong, fitter, stronger, more flexible. I would like to compete in a sport. I would like to do an athletic pursuit. I am a sports person. And all the many other reasons why people come to see an exercise professional, how do we choose the exercises that we're going to give people? And it really is a bazillion dollar question because there are literally millions, if not bazillions, of exercises. And there are lots of opinions and ideas about what's a good exercise and what's a bad one. And I'm sure that you have your very personal opinion and perhaps a public opinion about what is a good exercise and what's a bad exercise. I'm also pretty sure that you've looked at people exercising in the gym or in the park or doing exercises at home, or you've seen pieces of exercise equipment on television and you've thought that is either a really stupid exercise or that's a really good one. And we have a way in our own headspace of analyzing whether or not an exercise is safe or unsafe, whether it's effective or not, whether it wastes our time or actually give us the best result possible for what we want. So how do we open up that big box of which are the best exercises? As an exercise professional, obviously the number one rule is that you would never injure your client. And the reason for that number one rule, of course, is if you injure your client because you've given them a stupid exercise or a dangerous exercise, is it possible now that they won't be able to exercise at all, or they'll have a much more limited opportunity to get their body fit and strong? And obviously the human body, the less active it is, the more likely it is to get fat, the more likely it is to get sick, the more likely it is to get old really fast. So as an exercise professional, if rule number one is that we won't injure our client, is rule number two that we'll get them as fit and strong and flexible as possible so they can live their life and do the things that they want to do. And could that be a really great place to start with every person that asks us, please help me to get fit and strong, or please help me with my goal, that we prescribe, we design, we give people exercises and exercise programs that get them fit and strong and flexible for what they want to do. So is there a difference between getting somebody fit and strong for a marathon versus playing a team sport versus climbing a mountain versus doing a martial art versus playing tennis versus getting fit for having a baby or being fit to be a corporate business person sitting in a desk? And you could say the answer is yes, everybody's different and everybody needs different exercises. You could go to the other end of the scale and say everybody has the same bones and muscles. And is it possible that if we get everybody's bones and muscles strong, and if we get everybody's heart and lungs fit, if we get everybody's endocrine system, hormonal system working effectively, that they will then be able to go and do all the things that they want to do? And it's an interesting question to ask yourself as an exercise professional. Do I design programs to get people fit for what they want to do? And or do I design and get people fit and strong so they can go and do what they want to do? It doesn't matter which answer you have for those both of those questions. As an exercise professional, if we are responsible for people's health, for their fitness, for their strength, and for them achieving their health and fitness goals or their sporting goals, then should it be, or could it be, or is it our responsibility to make sure that the exercises that we give people do exactly that? They get people fit, strong, and flexible in the safest way possible so they get the best results possible for whatever it is that they want to do. So what a great place to start. So if we're going to get people fit, there's a lot of argument about What are the best exercises to get people fit? Could the best question to ask rather than argue is, what does this person want to get fit for? And is it possible that if we have a heart and lung system that gets puffed, then it will get fit? And it seems to be that there's very little argument about that now. The scientists argue about a lot of things: exercise professionals, fitness instructors, personal trainers, gym instructors, boot camp instructors, all argue about a lot of things. One of the things that can't be argued about, it has been suggested that if you want to get fit, you have to overload your heart and lungs, your cardiovascular system, your respiratory system. So you have to get puffed. Now, how you get puffed, of course, may relate to what sport the person does, or what activities they like to do the best or the most, or the thing that they hate the least. But ultimately, we've got to get people puffed. So whether they're getting puffed boxing or skipping or running or bike riding or sprinting or boxing, does it matter? And as an exercise professional, if you understand how your cardiovascular system and your respiratory system work and what happens when the body gets fit, and the benefits of fitness, which of course is a body that has everything circulating more effectively, we're going to have better hair, better skin, better nails, better immune system, so we're going to look better and feel better and have less chance of getting sick. When you're fit, you have a faster metabolism, so you burn fat faster at rest. You have a respiratory quotient which prefers to burn fat rather than carbohydrate, so you literally turn your body into a fat burning machine. And when you get puffed, you pump happy drugs through your brain, which means you're having neurogenesis. Your brain cells are regenerating. You're literally getting your clients to be able to think better, to take on information better, and most importantly, to feel better, to feel happy. So that's the wrap up of fitness. If you wanted to put it into a simple package, is let's get people fit. To get fit, you've got to get puffed. When you get puffed and you are fitter, you now have a body that's a fat burning machine. It circulates everything more effectively. You have a better immune system, and you are a happier person because you've got happy drugs pumping through your brain. Now, the question then is, how often do you exercise, and how many times a day or how many times a week? How often should you get puffed? And yes, we need to work that answer out for ourselves and for our clients. But if getting puffed pumps happy drugs through your brain, and if getting puffed turns your body into a fat burning machine, is it possible that it's something we could do on a really regular basis, every day, if not several times throughout the day? Because the question is, how long does it take to get puffed? And doesn't matter who you are, whether you're really fit or really unfit, everybody gets really puffed in about 10 to 15 seconds. If you put a big effort in, you go as hard as you possibly can, you will get puffed. Maybe some people will go 20 seconds, maybe 30 seconds. But the longer you go, the less effort you put in, because the longer you know you have to go, the more you pace yourself. So it's interesting, if you really push really hard and you just tell people, go as hard as you can, there's no time limit on it, just go as hard and fast as you can, and when you've got absolutely no breath left, you can stop. That's usually somewhere between 10 to 15 seconds. And it's a great exercise, obviously, pardon the pun, a great exercise to put everybody through, to find out how long does it take you to get puffed. And the other interesting thing there is, we often put limits on people, or we extend that limit to a point where they are pacing themselves. So somebody might get really, really puffed if they put in a big effort in 10 or 15 seconds, but we tell them they've got to go for 30 seconds. So they actually pace themselves, so they're not getting as puffed as they could. And the beautiful thing about high intensity, huffy puffy exercise, high intensity sprint training, any form of getting puffed for a short period of time, there are massive benefits. And the research is overwhelming on how beneficial it is to get puffed, have a rest, get puffed, have a rest, rather than just do long, slow distance exercise. So a great thing to ask is, what am I getting you fit for? However, if I'm going to get you fit, and I'll just use the extreme as an example. We usually talk about, if I'm going to run a marathon or do an Ironman, that I need to do lots of long distance exercise. Here's a great question to ask. If I'm really fit, so I get puffed, turn my body into a fat burning machine, and turn my heart and lungs into a super fit machine, And if I get really strong, so now I've got a really fit body and a really strong body, the question is, for long distance events, am I using my body to push me over 42.2 kilometers, or am I using my brain? And it's interesting because a lot of people will answer that it's about 80 to 90% mental toughness to run a marathon or mental toughness to do an Ironman. So often we get people to do long distance training to do long distance events. But here's a great question to ask. Every time I plant my foot on the ground under pressure, every time I turn my knee on a bike, every time I put rotational forces through my shoulders when I go swimming, they are or can turn into overuse injuries. There are lots of people who do long distance anything and they are constantly suffering from sore knees, sore feet, sore shoulders, sore back because they're overusing their joints. So obviously that's got a lot to do with strength, but also really important, if we can get people fit and strong enough in the shortest period of time without having to put those continual pounding forces through their body by doing long distance running or cycling or swimming, is it possible that somebody could still be fit enough, strong enough, or the fittest and strongest they could possibly be to do a marathon or an Ironman or a triathlon? And it's a really great question and something to really consider. Just because everybody's telling everybody that they have to do long distance running to run a marathon, do we actually have to put our client's body or our athlete's body through that? Or could we get them fit and strong? And then they would be quite capable to mentally push themselves over 42.2 kilometers because they've got strong joints, strong bones, strong muscles, and a really fit heart. So something to consider. So from a fitness point of view, as an exercise professional, if you get your people fit, you'll turn them into a fat burning machine. They will have a fast metabolism. They'll have a great immune system and they'll have happy drugs pumping through their brain. How you decide to get them fit, you have to work out what you're going to do for your client, what's going to be best for them. But the overwhelming research is that the harder and faster you puff, the fitter you'll get and the quicker you'll get fit. And you'll get the best results. So it's something very interesting to consider. Now, to get people strong, there's a great question, strong for what? And if I can get all of my clients to have every muscle and bone and joint in their body really strong, is it possible then they can go and do all of the things that they want to do or any sport that they decide to do or any activity that they decide to do? So if my client has a strong body, strong bones, strong muscles, strong joints, and on top of that, a strong brain, so they're mentally tough, then is it possible that they can then go out and do everything that they want to do? So I don't need to train my athlete necessarily for their sport because they can go and do the skill for their sport or while they play sport or while they train for their sport. But is it my responsibility as an exercise professional to make sure that every muscle and bone in their body is strong? And then that number one rule again, which is I'll never injure my client, is it my responsibility to make sure that the exercise program that I give them doesn't ruin their joints, doesn't injure them, doesn't hurt them, barring accident. So of course, if somebody drops a weight on their toe or they trip over in the gym or they get bitten by a jellyfish in the ocean while they're swimming, then obviously those things are accidents. It's not something that you do on purpose. But as an exercise professional, on purpose, I don't want to injure my client. So now comes exercise selection. Now the challenge with everything that I'm going to ask you now is that if you have an emotional attachment to an exercise, if you have a strong opinion about an exercise, if you've been doing an exercise for a really long time and you haven't been injured, if you've been prescribing an exercise for a really long time and you haven't seen anybody get injured, then there may be some argument and discussion about some of the questions I'm about to ask. But all I am asking that you do as an exercise professional is, number one, don't injure your client. Number two, be open to learning. One of the things that I found really interesting, because I did my first course in exercise prescription or exercise selection over 40 years ago now, and it was a very short course, and I was taught a lot of things in a very short period of time. What I didn't learn how to do was think for myself. Since then, I have done 9 other courses, qualification courses, and that's not because I'm a silly person, it's just because I like to keep learning. Every one of those courses taught me a lot of things and told me what to do, but none of them taught me to think for myself. They gave me a lot of information and there were yes, no answers in the exam, and I just learnt stuff without thinking about it. And then I met Cayman, and he was very successfully teaching people to think for themselves. And his original college was the National College of Fitness in Australia, which he started in 1989. With the number one rule of that college and right through to now at the Max International Colleges is education is not about telling you what to think. It's about getting you to think for yourself. So one of the really important things about exercise selection, I'm sure that you would love to be able to do, is not take somebody else's opinion or somebody else's advice or hope that they're telling you the truth, and not even take people's research information, because there's lots of contradicting research. What if we could just think for ourselves? And obviously that starts with an understanding of anatomy and physiology. If you've got a really good understanding of the muscles and bones of the body and how they work together to get your body moving around, and if you have a really good understanding of the muscular system, the skeletal system, the digestive system, the respiratory and cardiovascular system, and most importantly, the endocrine system, then it's very likely that you'll be able to figure out for yourself, think for yourself, analyze for yourself whether an exercise is safe or unsafe. And that's all I'm asking you to do as an exercise professional, rather than being convicted or opinionated or in love with a certain exercise just because you've been doing it for years. And of course, you have every right to do that. You can do whatever you bloody well want, of course. It's your body and you can exercise it however you want to. The challenge we have as exercise professionals is if people trust us that we're going to get them fittest and strongest and most flexible in the safest way possible, in the shortest period of time, in the most effective way possible, then is it important for us to be able to analyze each exercise that we're giving and be able to justify it? And as Cayman puts it so beautifully, could we justify it in a court of law? If somebody wanted to sue us for prescribing a certain exercise, would we be able to justify why we had prescribed that exercise for that person, and prescribed that exercise because it was safe? It was effective, it didn't waste people's time, it was functional, and there's an interesting word there because it's thrown around a lot lately. What is a functional exercise? So let's have a look at the main things to consider when you look at any exercise. Of course, is the exercise safe? And barring that weight falling on your toe, is there anything about that exercise that could hurt my client? And the biggest one to obviously be aware of is that the joints of the body will break down, wear down, explode, blow out much quicker than a muscle or a bone. So it takes a fair bit to pull a muscle and it takes a fair bit to break a bone, but it takes very little for a joint to degenerate, a joint to be injured. And the question is, if I put compression forces through my joints versus shearing forces, which one is going to be more or less likely to give me an injury? Now, you'll hear the analogy on a regular basis. If you get a piece of wood and a piece of sandpaper and you push them into each other, nothing will happen. That's a compression force. If I take that sandpaper and rub it across the wood, I will now have a wearing away of the wood, and that's just sandpaper. And that's called a shearing force. So if you have a look at shearing forces in any joint in the body, whether you do them one time or 5,000 times, is there a chance that a shearing force exercise could cause somebody an injury? And the interesting thing is that you might, and I often hear this, oh, don't do this exercise if you've got a sore joint, which is really interesting because if you keep doing that exercise, you might get a sore joint. It could be the logical conclusion from that. Would that be a fair question to ask? So if somebody's a smoker, for example, well, look, you won't, you just, if you've got cancer, you really shouldn't smoke. But if you haven't got cancer, it's okay to smoke. Well, that just sounds ridiculous, of course. And exercise selection is very much the same. If there's any chance that that exercise could cause damage, then why would we do it? I'm asking you to seriously consider that question. If there's any chance that exercise could cause damage in the short term or the long term, why would we give somebody that exercise? And the challenge with the shearing force is the pressure is going across the joint. You are shearing across the joint. Gravity is pushing across the joint, which will either cause damage immediately or in the long term. And let's have a look at why it would happen immediately. If you've got an athlete that, for instance, plays netball and they've already got shearing and rotational forces constantly going through their knees, if you put them into an exercise like a leg extension, for example, where you're now putting a shearing force across the joint, the very first time they do that leg extension, they may have a knee blowout. And can you imagine how that would feel, you as an exercise professional, picking an exercise that's common, everybody does it, it's a normal thing to do, you put your netballer in the leg extension, they do one exercise and they blow out their knee joint. Now, I'm arguing from the extreme for a reason, because it's happened and it will happen again and it happens every day. Now, the other thing that might go on is you put somebody in a leg extension, for example, you put shearing forces across their knee, you might get them to point their toes in or out. So now you've got shearing forces and rotational forces. And they might not hurt their knee the first day or the second day or the third day. But if you are continually putting shearing forces across the joint, is it possible that in the future they will have sore knees? And do you want to be responsible for somebody wanting to be able to exercise when they're 40, 50, 60, 70 years of age, but they can't because they've got damaged knees, their knee joint has been severely damaged because you've been putting continual shearing forces across their knees. I'll just use that one as an example. The other one that's really interesting is anything to do with the elbow joint. We often talk about bicep curls and tricep kickbacks, and you'll see them in every gym, and you'll see most exercise people, fitness instructors, gym instructors, doesn't matter where you go, people are doing bicep curls and tricep kickbacks. But that elbow joint, it's an interesting joint because you use it all the time, and a bicep curl and a tricep kickback are now shearing forces across that joint. If I do a push-up through the joint or I pull through that joint, then I have compression forces and traction forces through that elbow joint rather than shearing forces. And is it possible that if I do a really big exercise with my upper body, that because I have to use my arms to lift the weight, that I'll still be using every muscle in my arm without putting those dangerous shearing forces across the elbow? And once again, if you've got somebody that's been using that elbow for golf or for tennis, because they're the two common injuries, golfer's elbow and tennis elbow, and somebody comes to your gym and you just give them, oh, everybody does bicep curls, so you give them a dumbbell, they pick up the dumbbell, they do an exercise and they've blown out their elbow joint. Do you want to be the exercise professional that is responsible for that happening? And it might not happen on the first time, it might not happen on the thousandth time. It might just be a slow degeneration and wearing away of that elbow joint because somebody's doing bicep curls and tricep kickbacks on a regular basis. Now, of course, everybody can do whatever exercise they want to, and most people, it's a bit like smoking again. A lot of people know that smoking's bad for them, but they do it anyway because they like it. And a lot of people do leg extensions and bicep curls and tricep kickbacks because they like them. The challenge is, as an exercise professional, you can do whatever exercise you like to do, of course. But if you buy into, I will not hurt my client, then should it be a consideration that you don't want to put shearing forces through somebody's joints? The next one that's really interesting is the L4, L5 joint in the spine. And I'm asking about that one in particular because that's the one that has shearing forces when you do sit-ups or crunches. Even if you do, you turn the person over and you give them planks. If you're getting somebody to hold a plank for a really long time, think about where the shearing force is. Where is the gravitational push versus the position of the body? And if you have a look at a person that has an L4, L5 injury, or they get a perforated disc, a blown out disc. Now we're not just talking about difficult to sit down or difficult to move your arms, or if you've got a knee injury, you can still box, or if you've got an elbow injury, you can still use your legs. When you've got L4, L5 injury, it's very difficult to do anything. And if you put somebody into a sit-up position or a crunch position and they're over and over and over and over putting a shearing force of a lightweight over and over and over and over, now you are shearing away the disc between L4 and L5. And what's really cool, and it's the only way I can put it, is that most people hate doing sit-ups anyway. They do them because they think they have to. They don't do enough of them to wear that disc away. But if you are constantly prescribing people to do sit-ups or crunches or planks or any of those exercises where we're on the floor, so we're putting a shearing force through the L4, L5 joint, but we're also not doing anything. Obviously, you're not burning fat. If you could burn fat off your stomach from doing sit-ups, that would mean that you could burn fat off your face from chewing chewing gum, or you could have skinny fingers from playing the piano, or you could do neck crunches and burn fat off your neck. I think we're well past that now as a profession. We do understand that you can't take fat off wherever you want to. The other great way to consider that is that if you could take it off where you want to take it off, it means you could put it on where you want to put it on. So if you eat a nice big fatty meal, you should be able to push that fat into your boobies or in your bum and take it off your off your tummy. And of course, that's just ridiculous. Your body has fat cells. They expand when you eat fat and they reduce when you burn fat off. But you don't burn fat off in a spot that you want it to come off from. When you get fit and you exercise really hard and you stimulate your endocrine system, every fat cell in your body opens up, releases fat from the fat cell, and now you get to burn it off. So when we put somebody onto the floor, they're not burning fat. That doesn't work, obviously. They're grinding their L4, L5 joint away, so you could perforate their disc, injure their disc, and make it impossible for that person to exercise on an ongoing basis. And interestingly, where does the strength come from? The ultimate strength is the abdominals and the lower back work together to hold you in the upright position to be able to do every exercise, big exercise that you'd like to do. So if you're on the floor, half of the exercise isn't even being done because the floor is supporting your back, not your back muscles, and they're not working together. That's the most important thing about that commonly used term, the core. The muscles that hold you in the upright position is the front part of your body and the back part of your body working together to hold you in the upright position. And if you're on the floor, that's obviously not happening. The other really important thing to remember is how many sports are played on the floor. If you play netball or rugby league, or you go skiing, or you are a cross country runner or a marathon runner or a BMX rider or any of the sports that you can think of, they're in the upright position. The human body works best in the upright position. The most calories are burnt in the upright position. So why do we ever exercise the body in a lying down position or on the floor? It's a really interesting question to ask. And as an exercise professional, could you please ask the question? The same question that every person has the right to ask us. Whether they're an athlete or a child or a doctor or an allied medical professional, every client that comes into our lives, every person that knows we're an exercise professional has the right to ask us, why are we doing this exercise and how does it work? And if we can't answer that question, not just some regurgitated information that we got from somebody else off a website or off a blog or out of a magazine, but actually understand, why are we doing this exercise and how does it work? It would be difficult to be able to explain to somebody, why are we doing sit-ups? They don't burn fat. They don't increase strength. They wear away your joints, hurt your joints, and you aren't using your back muscles because you're lying on the ground. So why are we doing it? I don't know. How does it work? It doesn't. So they're two really important questions that, as an exercise professional, please be aware that everybody has the right to ask you those two questions. And do we have to have the answer as an exercise professional My suggestion would be yes. It's a bit like asking a mechanic, where's the wheel, where's the steering wheel, where's the carburetor, where's the engine, and how do they work? And if the mechanic doesn't know, I'm sure you wouldn't take your car there. So let's be the exercise professionals that have really strong, solid understanding of anatomy and physiology. So when somebody says to us, why are we doing this and how does it work, we actually have an answer for it. So if we're going to keep our clients' joints really safe, then is it important to avoid shearing force exercises, which means we would have to take a very careful look at anything that puts a shearing force across the shoulder joint, the elbow joint, the lower back, particularly L4, L5, and the knee joint. And then please be aware that anytime you do something over and over and over and over and over again, like running or biking or swimming for long distances, for long periods of time, now we might not be talking about shearing forces, we're just talking about overuse force. So people end up with sore feet, sore knees, sore back just because they're doing too much. And is it possible to get people really fit and really strong and just do a small amount of exercise? And that would be a very good question to ask. Not how much exercise do I have to do, but how little do I have to do to get the best results possible? So I'm not going to injure my client. I'm going to get my client really fit. So I'm going to get them puffed and I'm going to get them really strong. And obviously, from a strength point of view, I'm going to pick exercises that won't hurt them. The next question is, how many times do I do the best exercises? And if you have a look at the best exercises, they're obviously the ones that use as many muscles as possible at one time so that you fire up that endocrine system, so that you have a really rock-solid hormonal system, so that your muscles grow strong, your bones grow strong, and you feel really good. We often hear people complaining about my hormones this and my hormones that. Well, people that are really fit and strong have stronger muscles, stronger bones, they grow stronger muscles and stronger bones more effectively because their endocrine system's on fire and they have less challenges with all the other hassles with the hormonal system, particularly women with menopause and periods and mood swings, etc. It's really interesting to see what happens with women that are really fit and really strong when it comes to their hormonal system. So if we get people really fit and we get people really strong, then they're going to get the best results possible for everything that they want to do. So the big exercises produce the big results, and the big exercises are the ones that don't produce shearing forces across the joint or any joints, and they use as many muscles as possible in the most functional way possible. And I say that with hesitation because there's so much stuff now about functional exercise. And my question to you as an exercise professional is, what do you consider to be functional? And there's two arguments. One is functional for what the person does in real life, and the other one is functional for how the human body works. And the only question that I would like you to consider, please, is regardless of what the person does, so whether it's rock climbing or they perform in a circus or they are a downhill skier or they're a swimmer, any of those activities, any sporting activity, athletic pursuit may not be functional. One could argue that being a CrossFit athlete or being a rugby league player or being a performing act in a circus, none of those are functional activities. But the question is, do I want to get my client as fit and strong as possible so they can go and do their dysfunctional sport? So do I want to train them dysfunctionally so they can go and do their dysfunctional sport, which means I'd have a double dangerous. Their sport's already dangerous or their activity's dangerous. Do I really want to train them dangerously? So could the best definition for function be that how does the human body work safely so that I don't hurt any of the joints, so that if the person's going out to do a dangerous sport, that they've got the strongest joints, the strongest muscles, and the strongest bones possible. And if you have a look at that, those anatomical functions of the body, we can push with our upper body, we can pull with our upper body, we can lower our body down to the ground and get back up again. Very functional movements. They're the things that the human body is designed to do without putting shearing forces across the joints. So if we picked big exercises that use every muscle possible, and then we did as many of those as we possibly can, there's often a big argument about how many reps and how many sets. How do we know? I don't know how many exercises or how many of each exercise you can do. Would a great question be, how many can you do? Let's find out, and let's not stop until you can't do any more. We often hear, let's do 3 sets of 10. Well, it's a great question to ask. First, why is it 3? And why is it 10? Why isn't it 11? Why isn't it 2 sets? Why do we stop at 10? If somebody can't do 10, they're going to feel really stupid. And if they can do more than 10, why would we stop them? If their human body to overload means to get stronger. If I want my client to get strong muscles and strong bones, I have to overload them. So if I stop them at 10 and they can do 11 or 12, I'm not overloading their muscles or bones. The other thing I won't be doing is overloading their headspace. And the most beautiful thing about high intensity of any activity, whether it's huffy puffy or strength training, is yes, I'll get fitter and yes, I'll get stronger, but I'll get mentally tougher. So if I think that I can do 7 or 8 and I do 9, 10 or 11 of anything, if I think that I can sprint for 100 meters and I sprint for 110, or if I think you tell me I can sprint for 10 seconds and I go 11 or 12, yes, I'm going to get fitter. Yes, I'm going to get stronger. But most importantly, I'm going to get mentally tougher. And the same in reverse. If I'm capable of doing 15 or 20, if I'm capable of sprinting 100 meters and you stop me at 50, then I'm going to be underloading and I will get mentally weaker because I know I can do more, but I don't. And every time I do that to my own headspace, I become mentally soft. So if we want our athletes, and that's the big thing about any athletic pursuit, is if you start on the start line at the beginning of the competition, at the start of the game, and you know that you are as fit and strong as possible, and most importantly, you are as mentally tough as possible, then you know that you've got more likelihood of doing really well at that particular sport or activity. So why do we stop people at a certain number? Why don't we just get people to do as many as they possibly can? Now, yes, there are, if you understand physiology, there are certain energy systems in the body. And if you are exercising in the wrong energy system, so with strength training, for example, if you're doing 20 or 30 of each exercise, it's too many. Apart from the fact that you'll get bored to tears, the weight that you're lifting is now too light if you can do it 20 or 30 times. So the recommendation from the best in the world when it comes to testing and measuring the capability of muscle, the suggestion is that if you can do anywhere between 6 to about 15 of any exercise and you could keep going past 15, then it's time to put the weight up. So do as many as you possibly can. Don't stop at a number. Just keep going. Rowie, how many should I do? As many as you can. But if you're doing more than 15, and that day you might do 20, but it means that next time you train, it's time to lift heavier weight, lift a heavier bucket of sand, put another log in your wheelbarrow, pick up another heavier weight. But to get stronger, you have to overload. You have to overload your muscles. You have to overload your bones. You have to overload your endocrine system. And most importantly, you have to overload your brain. So if you think you can only do 10 and you do 11, you'll now become mentally tougher. So if we wrap all of that up, how do we get strong? Pick the safest exercises possible, the ones that use the most muscle groups possible, the ones that use the body in a way that it works most safest, and I'll use the word functional very carefully. So if we're pushing with our upper body, we're pulling with our upper body, you lower your body down to the ground and get back up again. Obviously, you're going to be using the middle of your body, that term called the core, because otherwise, if your core's not holding you in the upright position, then you just fall forward. And that's why it's such a powerful exercise when your abdominal muscles and your lower back muscles are working together to lift a really heavy weight. That's when they actually have to work really hard in the most functional way possible, and I use that word again. So I am an exercise professional, you're an exercise professional. None of us want to injure our client. I believe all of us want our clients to get the best results possible in the shortest period of time, in the safest way possible, with the best exercises possible. Let's get people fit, let's get them puffed. Let's get them puffed in a short period of time and not waste their time and injure their joints. Let's pick exercises, please, that don't injure somebody's joint. You have the right to injure your own joints, but I really believe that as exercise professionals, and I'll ask the question, do we have the right? to put somebody's joint in a position where it could get injured immediately or in the future? And I hope that that your answer to that question is no. So let's pick exercises that don't put shearing forces across the joint. They put compression forces through the joint. So we have strong joints, strong bones, strong muscles, a strong headspace, and a human being that can then go out and do whatever it is that they want to do, whether their sport is functional or dysfunctional, whether their sport is safe or unsafe, it doesn't matter, because me as the exercise professional, I'm going to make sure that every single one of my clients has a fit, strong, healthy body, a fit, strong, healthy mind, and they're ready to go out and live their life. And most importantly, I'm pumping happy drugs through their brain as often as possible throughout the day so they feel good all the time. What a great career path. What do you do, Roey? I help people to be healthy, fit and strong and to pump happy drugs through their brain. Is that what you do too? Woohoo!